The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome back to the program today Jeremy Zimmerman. He joins us on the telephone down in Kentucky. Hello, Jeremy.
How are you doing?
Excellent. Last time we had you on the show was for your book about making mead, and here you are again. That one was called Make Mead Like a Viking, and now your new book is Brew Beer Like a Yeti, Traditional Techniques and Recipes for Unconventional Ales. Is it Gruits?
Groot.
Groot.
Some people might say Gruit, but I say Groot.
Groots and other ferments using minimal hops. Am I pronouncing Yeti correctly?
Yes. I was actually on a TV show in Portland, and a lady said Yeti.
Yeti?
Yeah, but it's more just Yeti.
Well, Yeti's kind of your tag, isn't it? Isn't that sort of your nickname?
Yeah, that's where it came from. I started blogging as just decided out randomly to pick a pseudonym, and Redheaded Yeti was what I went with.
Okay.
And that was before the first book, and then I just kind of started to become known as that. And this book goes well beyond Vikings, so the publisher and I decided to find some sort of a parallel title, and that's what we went with.
Well, there are definitely a lot of similarities between the books because you get into the history of these beverages, and it's fascinating to read the history and the legends and the folklore, and you have a lot of that in here. Tell us how you got into this home brewing thing. How did this happen to you?
Well, my very first brew was actually when I lived in Seattle. I moved from my home state of Kentucky and lived there about 8 years. And, you know, you can't throw a stone without hitting a brewery, brew pub, or coffee shop. And, you know, she was looking for something new to do and went and picked up a homebrew kit. And, you know, at that time I was doing everything the way you're supposed to, straightforward, following the instructions. And then over time I just got more and more experimental and got into mead and continued doing beer. And now I ferment all kinds of stuff.
And anybody that reads this new book or the previous book will realize that you're actually kind of a wild man when it comes to brewing. You're vastly into experimenting.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that is derived from my research into the history. I kept coming across recipes and techniques and stuff that just were nothing like the stuff that is common today among brewers. So I started experimenting with things, and from wild yeast to just all kinds of wild forage ingredients or just ingredients that are in my own yard that I would never have thought that I could brew with. So, yeah, the history and the research really drove a lot of that.
Jeremy, tell us about beer. What is it? Beer has been in the headlines a lot lately. There's a guy trying to get a seat on the Supreme Court who said, I like beer. Everybody's thinking about beer right now. What is beer?
Yeah, beer is certainly becoming even more in the headlines as of late. And I'll give you the short answer. For the long answer, you might have to check out the book. But I found in my research, especially historically, that the definition of what beer is really kind of varies depending on who you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
But as we know it today, and as it pretty much it has been historically, is it is a grain-based alcoholic beverage. So for any kind of alcohol, you need to have a sugar to ferment. With mead, it's honey. With wine, it's fruits and usually additional sugar. And beer, you get the sugars by a process where you take grains, like barley, wheat, and other grains, and kind of malt them. So basically you're causing the seed to almost sprout, and then you cut that off with heat. And that's, you know, builds up some endosperm inside, and then that's, you know, long story short, you take that and that through the brewing process, you get the sugars from that endosperm and break down the starches. And there's all this scientific stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it's a beverage that, you know, you get from fermenting malted grains.
What's the difference between beer and ale? And you actually kind of try to explain that in your book.
Yeah, The way it's understood today is, you know, the different types of yeast kind of ferment differently. So ale tends to be a top ferment, meaning when you're fermenting, the yeast kind of creates this foam on the top, and you can kind of see that working. And that's kind of what an ale yeast will do. And when you're talking lager yeast, which is basically your, you know, Pilsner type beers, the, you know, the standard German beer you might get, they're actually a bottom fermenting yeast. And that is a technical definition today. But when I went into researching what people thought historically, it varied so much that it was really hard to tell. A lot of it had to do with the etymology of the words changing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so at one time, hops was not at all common, or most of history, hops was not a common ingredient in beer. So when it became more common, then for a while the definition was anything with hops in it is a beer. Anything that's fermented with other types of herbs and spices and other types of things would be an ale. But again, it got really frustrating, the research, because I don't think anybody ever really knew the difference. It just seems to keep changing over time.
Well, in recent times, with the explosion in craft brewing, we have found some brewers who have just really gone overboard with the hopping. I mean, it's just some of these beers. When you're talking about a quadruple IPA, I mean, this is just absurd.
Yeah, well, I would have to agree with you there. I do enjoy hops in my beer. I have nothing against them. I enjoy the occasional IPA, but I am definitely not, you know, an IPA fan in general. And I think a lot of it has to do with just it was a trend, and I think it's a downward trend. I think it might be people are starting to experiment with a lot of the other possibilities, the various herbs and lots of other flavorings you can use. But yeah, I think it got a little overdone there for a bit.
The book is Brew Beer Like a Yeti. Jeremy Zimmerman joins us. You go back to the history, and it's kind of amazing to learn that they were brewing beer a really long time ago, and archaeological discoveries have shown that they were brewing it in large quantities, even way back, thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah, it's gone, you know, they're discovering more recently that's even further back than they thought. I mean, there are a couple of archaeologists I follow who specialize in kind of finding these, you know, ruins where it looks like, whereas previously people thought that they were cooking or something there, that it actually looked like they were malting grains and had all kinds of, you know, fairly large vessels that couldn't have been used for anything else other than brewing. I mean, as far back as like Neolithic man, I mean, all you really need is heat, some rocks.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, just there's not, you know, you can do it with some pretty rudimentary stuff.
And in your book, you show us how to brew with rocks.
Yeah. I actually did one of those just this last weekend.
Uh-huh.
And what that is, it's actually in Germany, it's called Steinbier.
Uh-huh.
Stein, like rock, or I think it stands for stone. But yeah, anyway, it's to get that to happen. Yeah, I mean, you have to get the sugars to ferment beer. You have to subject the grains to a lot of heat. And so before we had, like, you know, stoves and propane tanks and all that, they would heat up rocks in a fire and drop them very carefully into the liquid, and it causes all kinds of hissing and steaming and caramelizes the grains. And yeah, that's, so basically you can just make beer with just a fire and some really hot rocks.
Sounds like fun.
It is. You got to be careful, though, to choose the correct rocks. they've got to be really solid. Granite is the best. If
uh-huh.
you get anything porous, especially from like a riverbed or something, it will explode.
Oh, my. Jeremy Zimmerman joins us. Going back into history again, we see where the area, which is now Germany, which back during Roman times was filled with all these various tribes who the Romans looked down their noses at because they drank this rotted barley water. And then they basically took over Rome, didn't they? They overwhelmed the Romans, and in the same area, brewing became such a fine art that they came up with actual laws which said these four ingredients are the only things that are allowed. Let's talk about this in the historical German connection.
Yeah, in Germany, actually, kind of in the area of Bavaria, they came up with what a lot of brewers still follow it today. And I'm pretty sure I got my pronunciation down at this point, but it's the Reinheitsgebot.
Mm-hmm.
Those long German words are fun. But, and they're actually, in my research, it's another one of those things where it's a little sketchy as to tell us exactly why it happened. Part of it may have been for commercial reasons. So the four ingredients are barley, hops, water, and yeast. And originally it was just barley, hops, and water because yeast was just kind of a given. But, over time they actually put that as an ingredient.
Mm-hmm.
And you can brew beer with all kinds of grains, but one of the reasons, from what I understand, was that they wanted the wheat to be set aside specifically for the bread bakers. And it was never really intended to go beyond Bavaria, but somehow it just kind of stuck. And, today, if you get a German beer that's made by those rules, it can be an amazing beer. I mean, I have no issue with brewing that way because it's very much about brewing in a very specific way and being as, the German beer purity law is another, is basically what Reinheitsgebot means. So it's just as good, they've got really strict standards as to how they brew it, and you can make an excellent beer with it. But it limits a lot of the other things that you can put in beer.
Hmm. The Germans have been brewing beer for a long, long time, and we have this brewing situation in our country where it was broken up by Prohibition, and this really changed everything, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Prohibition was the grand experiment that failed miserably. It changed a lot of things in our country, and we lost a lot of the art of brewing and distilling and all that because it had to. There are definitely people in the backwoods and in speakeasies and all that trying to keep it going, but a lot of those people were making a rock cut and actually making people sick.
Mm.
So people are going to drink. Not everyone, but you can't stop the ones that want to.
And so after Prohibition ended, all those little operations for malting and brewing had pretty much been wiped out, and all you had left was the big industrial brewers.
Yep, that's pretty much it. That's why it came down to, I don't remember the exact number, but pretty much four or five that, just that kind of all, pulled together all the stuff that the small brewers are left behind, and it just kind of became this big monolith. And it took until around the late 70s, early 80s, was when craft beer started to come back and home brewing was made legal.
And you mentioned the one that I think of being the first as far as bringing back the Renaissance, and that was Anchor Steam Beer out of San Francisco. Tell us about them.
Yeah, they were one that had actually managed to hold on. They were one of the few small ones. I'm not sure if they were operational throughout Prohibition, but they got going pretty quick afterwards. And for a while, they were brewing the standard stuff that all the big ones were doing, the corn and rice-based, really light, fizzy kind of a beer that didn't have a whole lot of alcohol or flavor to it. But interestingly, a guy named Fritz Maytag, who is related to the guy who invented the Maytag washer, bought it, and he was really into all kinds of other things like cheese and distilling. But he decided to resurrect one of their old, kind of strong barley and hops-based recipes. And he was a savvy businessman, so he it was tough at that time to convince anybody to drink that kind of thing. But he kind of kick-started the craft brewery and then eventually the home brewing movement too.
And you explain what steam beer is. I had never heard that explained.
Well, it's, again, one of those things that no matter how many sources I checked, there's no way of really saying for sure. One of the things that some people say is because they would, when they're setting after they cook the beer wort. Wort is what beer is before it's fermented.
Mm-hmm.
They would set it out to cool in what are called cool ships, I think. So it'd be usually on a roof, just big open flat container. And as it was cooling, you know, steam would rise up from it. But lots of other beers were done that way too. So it's a little, I don't know if I can remember exactly what some of the other theories were for the name. But
The book is Brew Beer Like a Yeti, Traditional Techniques and Recipes for Unconventional Ales, Gruits and Other Ferments Using Minimal Hops. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And Jeremy, when I was reading the book, I learned an awful lot about brewing. I didn't know most of this stuff. And you devote a chapter to each one of these four ingredients, and you explain the importance of the ingredients and the way that they're used and the way that they're processed. And I was not aware of malting. This is a fascinating process.
Yeah, malting is usually the entire process from growing the grains to malting them to fermenting, you know, everything was all done at home on like farmhouses, farmsteads. And, you know, people would grow their own grains, they'd malt them, and then they would go and sell any extra, but other than that, but then, you know, the rest of it would just be for their family, and including kids, because they would make a very low-alcohol beer called small beer that was actually very nutritious because of the grains in it. But the malt houses, you know, again, that's another thing with Prohibition, that they just disappeared. And so most people will get their malt now, get it from just a couple really, really large operations. But over about the past 10, 15 years, I think, in the U.S. at least, artisanal malt houses have started to come back and are using local grains and malting them themselves and, you know, selling them to craft breweries and to home breweries. So that's kind of a movement of its own that is really starting to take form.
When you do the chapter on water, you say, well, this is probably going to be a really boring chapter, but it wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, my editor and I had decided that when we were working on the structure, you know, we knew that the Reinheitsgebot and those four ingredients needed to be covered somehow. So we decided to do a chapter on each of them, and then I do an additional chapter on all the other different things you can flavor it with. So, yeah, I went into it initially going, oh, okay, water. I'm going to write a chapter about water.
Uh-huh.
But then I started researching it, and there's, you know, I got a D-minus in high school chemistry, but there is a lot of interesting chemistry behind it and all kinds of things you can do to adjust your brewing water to give it different flavors, and all that has to do with minerals. You can actually buy certain types of minerals to make your water be more like water from Burton-on-Trent, which is in England.
Uh-huh.
They make more of an English-style ale.
That's where they made bitters.
Yes.
Right. And yes. We think of Bass from Burton-on-Trent, don't we?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. So, yeah, it was, you know, and water is obviously an extremely important thing to all of us. And if you think about it, when you drink a beer, it's mostly made up of water. So you obviously want that to be, you know, a good quality ingredient.
And back... Back in the good old days, when the water systems were non-existent, the water was pretty much a dangerous, undrinkable thing. People didn't drink water. They drank beer. They drank anything but water, didn't they?
Yeah, and we're talking, we go way back in the day, not quite so much, but when people started to settle and, you know, were putting together buildings and, you know, their sewage had to go somewhere, and they didn't really know how to take care of that properly. So, you know, the water system started to get polluted, you know, unless you knew of a good spring that nobody else did. That, you know, they learned that they needed to boil the water, and then that fermentation would make it even safer and also make it more flavorful. So, you know, funny thing is, water used to be looked at the way alcohol is by, you know, certain people today. It was kind of, it was an unpleasant substance that could cause you great harm, and it was much better for you to drink a beer than drink some water.
Well, some of us would agree that it's still that way.
Oh, yeah. Water is nice to have when you need it, but yeah, you know, something that's flavorful and has an effect is much nicer.
Heather beer. I was not familiar with heather beer. I'd seen someone who brewed some a few years ago. I think it was a Scottish brewery. They called this beer heather beer, but I didn't realize this was a legendary substance.
Yeah, it was actually, funny thing is that the heather story is kind of what kickstarted this book. I came across, you know, all this folklore about it when researching Make Mead Like a Viking, and kept having to put it aside because I just didn't, you know, it wasn't, I was writing about meat in that book, obviously. And it turns out there's this huge amount of legend and folklore behind brewing with heather, and it is specifically with a type of heather found in Scotland. And, you know, the interesting thing about that, the brewery, I can't think of their name myself, but I think the one you mentioned is probably the one that I first had a heather beer from.
Hmm.
They took some of the heather from Scotland and sent it out to be analyzed, and there's this powder residue that appears on it naturally, and it's referred to colloquially as the fog,
uh-huh.
F-O-G-G. And it's actually kind of a psychotropic sort of a substance, so they had to wash it before they used it in their beer. But, you know, one of the stories is that it's potentially what was used to give the Viking berserkers their rage.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and a lot of it, too, it's going into folklore, so you have to kind of take it with a grain of salt. And we don't know how true all of it was, but and the Picts were another ancient race that were pretty much wiped out, integrated with the Scots and other, you know, groups in that area. They were known for, you know, painting themselves blue and drinking this heather ale that just made them fierce warriors. You know, when I make it, I don't really feel that much like a fierce warrior, but it's tasty.
Yeah, the brand was what, Freyoc?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Freyoc Heather Ale.
I wasn't going to try to pronounce it, so I'm glad that you did.
Yeah. That's the only time I've ever seen it.
I think I have come across it recently. Well, online. They have a website, so they're still making it, but I don't think I've seen it in a brewery or a beer store in a while.
Okay. The book is Brew Beer Like a Yeti. Jeremy Zimmerman wrote it. Traditional techniques and recipes for unconventional ales, groots, and other ferments using minimal hops. Some of these listeners out there are saying, okay, what's a groot?
That's another complicated historical story. You know, one of those things that, you know, the more I dug into it, the more I was like, I can't really quite put a grasp on what it actually was. Today, it's kind of having a comeback, and a lot of people are brewing them, and it's just thought of as a beer made with herbs instead of hops. But historically, it was a lot more complicated than that. It was what people made before beer with hops came along. But, you know, it's a lot of people think of the term groot is for an herbal mixture. And, you know, a lot of the books say that it was kind of closely guarded and pretty much patented by certain breweries. But then when I go further back, and a lot of this is in Dutch, so I actually have a friend who is Dutch who helped me translate some stuff.
Oh.
And that's where groot really started. It was in the Netherlands. And it gets, you know, it gets more complicated. In some ways, the word actually refers to a tax on beer, kind of like, or a law, kind of like the Reinheitsgebot.
Okay.
And, you know, other sources were saying it might have been a mix of grains that were kind of prepared and then concentrated and then sent along, malted grains, and then sent to people to brew with.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know, the way most people think of it today is an herbal beer.
You have all these brewing recipes in here. Did you make every single one of these yourself?
No, I just kind of nitpicked. I just kind of picked them out and thought they looked good.
Yeah.
Yes, I made them all at least once.
Okay. Oh, you did.
Yeah.
All right.
Several of them, more than once, to kind of fine tune them, make sure that they were worth drinking.
So you tested them all out. This oak bark and mushroom beer. Now that sounds like a real Jeremy Zimmerman beer to me.
Yeah, I had a friend ask about that the other day who loves mushrooms, and he's like, "So does mushroom beer taste good?" Yeah, if you like mushrooms, it gives it an earthy sort of a flavor. But oak bark was, and other tree bark was another common thing. And we're talking about the inner bark, not the outer rough bark. So if you actually brew with it, it gives it very much a root beer sort of a flavor. And the original root beers actually had some bark in them as well.
Well, I would think the sassafras forest wheat would taste kind of like root beer.
Yes, that one. Now, if you like wheat beers and you like root beers, you know, those two go together so well that beer disappeared pretty quick.
This spruce pale ale sounds delicious.
Yeah, and that's another thing that was common, spruce and juniper, which we know as cedar in the U.S. But the you know, not all trees that have needles you can brew with or do anything with because they're toxic. It acts as a disinfectant, which is what another thing a hops does. And Captain Cook actually had a recipe. He found out that if he put spruce in his beer, his crew didn't get scurvy. So he had a special spruce beer recipe that he always brewed a whole bunch of before he went on his expeditions.
Wow. They would take a lot of beer that was really hopped up on these expeditions because they didn't want to spoil, but the spruce must have had vitamin C in it or something.
Yeah, that's what it was. It's got vitamin C in it. And, you know, the one reason hop beers became big was the IPA. It stands for India Pale Ale.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was when they, you know, in Britain they were going across to India, and they needed to put a whole lot of hops in there to have it keep. But from what I understand, they kept those hops long enough that they probably lost a lot of their strong bittering flavors, but they still worked as a disinfectant. So from what I gather, the amount of hops they put in by the time it got to where they were going, it probably tasted nothing like our IPAs. I think it was milder on the hops, but definitely strong in the alcohol.
You have a recipe in here for Gotlandstrika and the Roche beer. I've had the German Roche beer. I didn't care for it.
Yeah, well, you got to like smoky flavors.
Yeah, it tasted like it was barbecued.
Well, and that is one thing about beers made with smoked grains. Now, first, you have to like the flavor, but it can also be overdone or not done right. I mean, you can definitely have some that just aren't very good. The ones I do have a fairly mild smoky flavor to them.
Uh-huh. I'm guessing, knowing you, that you have some things in progress right now there at your location, some things that you're brewing or some mead that you're making, or what do you have going right now?
Well, I've currently got fermenting one of the stone beer that I started on. I did one just over the last weekend, and I have flavoring that. I have Eastern Red Cedar, which is the version of juniper that we have in my area in Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
and pretty much all over the East Coast. So I've got one of those going, and I need to get back to one that I've started, a banana beer. And I didn't come across this until after the book, but it's very commonly made in various parts of Africa.
Wow.
And it's with bananas, but also some grains, not as many as your standard beer. And they do it by mashing the bananas in a gourd with their feet,
uh-huh.
or taking a bunch of grass to kind of help, you know, hold the grass, and then they push it against the banana to get the pulp out. I just put it in a pot and used a spoon. But
well, with the sugars in bananas, if they're using really ripe ones, I would think that could be fairly alcoholic.
Yeah, it can be. It's also one, some of these traditional ones, you drink it while it's fairly young, so you drink it while it's still fermenting, and it becomes more alcoholic over time. But if you let it go for more than a couple weeks, it usually starts to get sour and funky because there's no, you know, disinfected in it like hops or anything like that.
I see.
But, yeah.
Well, sounds tasty.
I hope so. I haven't actually only just started making it.
Okay.
I can't see how it couldn't turn out good.
Well, Jeremy, we really appreciate you talking to us about your book.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
The book is Brew Beer Like a Yeti, Traditional Techniques and Recipes for Unconventional Ales, Groots, and Other Ferments Using Minimal Hops. It's beautifully done, published by Chelsea Green. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO for The Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.